It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. You know, there are certain issues that you get a tendency to tune out of because you've been hearing about them for so long and maybe nothing seems to happen, or they get very technical and there's different aspects to them. One of those could be the Alaska gas pipeline issue. But this is an issue that is so important and has so many dimensions affecting Alaskans' lives and economy for decades to come that it's really not one that you can afford to not know about. And so we're going to very painlessly today get into the topic of the Alaska gas pipeline, the different projects that are available, what the resource is, where it could go, and how it could affect our state government, our economy for decades to come. That's our topic today on Hometown Alaska, and we will welcome your calls and questions. I've got two experts in the studio who will be able to help you with anything you want to know, and I'll give you those numbers in just a moment. With me in the studio today, I have Tim Bradner, who is a natural resource reporter for Alaska Journal of Commerce. Thanks for being with us, Tim.
Thanks, Charles.
And I know you've been writing about this issue for a very long time and have written a lot of really clear and understandable stuff.
Oh, thank you.
And Larry Persily is with us. He's the federal coordinator with the Federal Office for Alaska Gas Line Projects. And this is a special office that was created, Larry, to essentially make sure that the federal government was in sync with whatever was going to happen in Alaska.
Right. The theory being that the office could try to ensure that the federal government doesn't do anything to make a difficult project any more difficult than it needs to be.
Right. But you're not a magician. You don't have a magic wand to make this project actually take place.
No, and I don't have $40 billion to spend.
Right. So just to start with, let's put in context, how much gas do we have in Alaska? The magnitude, and I guess the great majority of it is on the North Slope and produced in conjunction with the oil. How much is there on a national scale, on a world scale?
Well, I guess you're right. As you talk about this North Slope gas pipeline, we've been waiting decades for talking about North Slope gas. Setting aside what people think may be there, what is possible, but just dealing what's been proved, and that's what you've got to look at if you're going to spend $40, $50, $60 billion on a project. There are proved reserves of 35 trillion cubic feet of gas. People don't know what that means. What we know in Alaska are barrels of oil. If you convert those 35 trillion cubic feet of gas onto a barrels of oil equivalent, you're looking at almost 6 billion barrels of oil. It's a lot of oil. And it appears that maybe after almost 40 years, the times come where there might be a market, the economics might work. It would certainly be in Alaska's benefit to get that oil or that gas out of the ground, get it to market, and make some money.
Is it an amount of gas that people around the world, industrial folks or people building power plants in Asia or wherever else would be looking at and thinking, oh, there's something of major significance?
It is. There's thousands of trillions of cubic feet of gas around the world. What makes the Alaska prospect attractive is its proven reserves. It's already being produced. Like you say, we've been producing the gas for 36 years, re-injecting it into the ground to enhance oil recovery. So there's nothing unknown. I'm simplifying here. It's sort of putting a spigot in and diverting some of the gas flow into a pipe instead of continuing re-injection, cleaning it up and doing some other things to it. So it's very accessible and a very low-cost production because it's already being produced. It's not like they found four times as much gas offshore Tanzania and Mozambique in the last couple of years. There's no production facilities, roads, ports, airports. You'd have to build everything from scratch. Makes that gas, even though it's four times as much as we may have, very expensive and very difficult to get.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Tim Bradner, we know that we don't have enough gas here in Anchorage. There's this issue that or at least enough deliverability. Each winter we're told to have an experiment to turn down our water heaters or turn down our thermostats. I don't know how well that works. But the amount of gas that we use is pretty much insignificant compared to the amount of gas that's on the North Slope.
Well, that's true, Charles. It's ironic that we have a talked about gas shortage here in South Central Alaska because our gas fields, which were discovered decades ago in some cases, are winding down. And yet we have all this gas on the North Slope. A couple things about that. We haven't, you know, the gas fields in Cook Inlet, there's three or four big ones that have been the mainstay of our production. We haven't really explored for gas in Cook Inlet because it was, you know, it was surplus. We couldn't really do anything with it. it's sort of like the North Slope situation on a smaller scale. In the 1960s, we had so much. There was no gas distribution system in Anchorage. The companies went out and found very innovative, found ways of using the gas. One was to make fertilizer, so we had a fertilizer plant in Kenai. Another was to liquefy the gas and export it to Japan. And that had never been done before on that scale. And so that was done, and that plant's been operating. And then we built the gas distribution system in Anchorage. So over the years, a couple things have happened. The gas fields, Anchorage has grown, so we're using more gas. Gas system has been expanded to the Mat-Su and now to the Kenai, on down the Kenai Peninsula toward Homer. Larger population, more gas being used. Gas fields are declining to the point that the industrial plants are gone now, essentially. Mm-hmm. The fertilizer plant is closed down. The LNG plant is still there and still being maintained. Could restart, but is not exporting gas right now. But we're still facing a situation where we could be we could face a supply shortage here. Very ironic situation with all that gas sitting on the North Slope. There are explorers exploring in Cook Inlet, and luckily, we hope they'll find more.
Yeah, I saw a platform just north of Anchor Point as I drove up from the peninsula this weekend.
Yeah, that's one of them, and they're drilling right into a known gas deposit. What they don't know is whether they can economically produce it or not.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, Larry, my two guests today are Tim Bradner from the Alaska Journal of Commerce and Larry Persily, who's the federal coordinator for the Office for Alaska Gas Line Projects. And this is Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Woolforth. We welcome your calls, questions about this complex but really important issue. The number here in Anchorage is 550-8433. If you're calling from outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And you can reach us via email at, what is our email address anyway? I've lost track of it here. hometown@alaskapublic.org. hometown@alaskapublic.org. You can tell I'm doing too many radio shows and I can't remember the email address. So, Larry, there's multiple projects that have been talked about. We don't need to go back all the way to the 70s when they started talking about them, but there's the big projects to get the gas to big users, which are sort of like the Alaska Oil Pipeline in terms of their magnitude, this huge projects that where the economics are way beyond what we use in Alaska. And then there's also concepts of projects to bring North Slope gas to the South Central area. I know Governor Palin was pushing the idea, and Governor Knowles before her, of moving the gas through Canada in a huge pipeline. Now that appears to have gone away because gas prices in the lower 48 have gone down. What are the real projects that are on the table now and that are competing?
Well, you're right. This has bounced around from the late 60s, and there was that period earlier last decade where it looked like North America was going to run short of natural gas. So you spent the companies, BP, ConocoPhillips, Exxon, ARCO before them, spent a lot of money looking at whether you could move North Slope gas into the lower 48, running it through Canada. That looked possible until hydraulic fracturing, shale gas, production just boomed. Pennsylvania now alone is producing 6 billion cubic feet a day. To put it in that some perspective, that's on average 30 times what we produce out of Cook Inlet. So they just don't need gas in the lower 48 anymore from Alaska. The companies, BP, ConocoPhillips, Exxon, joined by TransCanada, now are working toward trying to put together the cost, the engineering, the commercial feasibility of a pipeline to Tidewater, liquefy the gas as they had done on a very small scale at the old Conoco plant at Nikiski for 40 years, liquefy the gas, put it in tankers, and sell it to Japan, Taiwan, India, China, South Korea. That project, they estimate between the gas treatment plant on the slope to take out carbon dioxide impurities, the pipeline, the liquefaction plant, dock, harbor facilities, $45 to $65 billion could be the most expensive energy project ever in the world.
And ships, too? Does that include ships?
No, the $45 to $65 billion estimate does not include the tankers.
Wow.
So that's one project that would move a large volume of gas by state law. It would have 5 offtake points along the line. You could take gas off to meet Alaskans' needs if someone's willing to pay for it. So that's one project. Companies are working on it, but I admit, and they'll admit, they don't know when they would have an answer and if the answer will be good. Meanwhile, you have a lot of people in the state are frustrated. It's been a long time. They think we need to seize the moment, take control, whatever, do it ourselves. So they've put together a state-funded initiative. It's called the Bullet Line, the Alaska Standalone Pipeline, the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, the In-State Line. It's all the same thing. It's a
bullet mean that it goes like a bullet from the North Slope to South
Point
Central?
8, okay. It doesn't stop along the way, but it would stop in Fairbanks. So I'm not sure why the Bullet Line. But it would be a much smaller line, maybe one-sixth the size of what the producers are looking at, but still substantial estimates, somewhere $5, $6, maybe $9 or $10 billion, still a very big project. They're doing engineering, permitting, design. They will also have to test the commercial feasibility. The state has fronted $430 million for that, but that's a small portion of the billions to pay. But they're looking to see, does that work? Is that a backup plan if the state, as a matter of policy, wants to give up on the big line? Those are the two big players. There's some others.
So that one's
there.
not big enough to export. It's just big
enough for
a small amount of export.
The economics of it only work because Alaska is such a small market. You'd still have to export. I believe when you look at the volume they're proposing, at least half of the gas that's in there. And the original business plan a couple years ago assumed half the gas would go out and export. Unless you get enough volume in there, the cost of building and using that pipe for the very small market in Alaska gets very high and very prohibitive. So
we'd be just paying too much money for gas.
Right. Their project does not include building a liquefaction plant. They assume someone else will deal with that if one's needed.
And when you say their project, is that the one that's being done by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation?
Right, a subsidiary of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, which by legislation passed this year, will move away as a subsidiary from Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to a separate standalone state corporation still under the Department of Commerce.
Okay. And one of the we talked about this pipeline that was going to go through Canada, and we spent, it seemed like we talked about it forever. There was a $500 million appropriation made to sort of seed that and get it going, and AGEA and all that. And we can get into some of those details later. But then it sort of evaporated because, as you said, the price of gas went way down in the lower 48. Price of gas, I guess, remains high in Asia. What's to keep it from going down over there and having
our... Commodity markets change. Someone comes up with a new way of growing soybeans, producing gas, it changes the market. What changed in Asia certainly is growth in China and the shutdown of all the nuclear plants in Japan after Fukushima in March 2011. But the state subsidy, if you will, the state $500 million agreement with TransCanada is not limited to the line through Canada to the lower 48. TransCanada back in 2008 in its proposal to the state said, we will build a line through Canada to serve the lower 48, or we'll build a liquefied natural gas export project at Tidewater and South Central, whichever one the market wants. In exchange for working toward that, the state is reimbursing them up to $500 million. They initially started on the line through North America, gave up on that a year ago. Now they're looking at the liquefied natural gas export project to use up the balance of that $500
million. Tim, you write about economics. The Alaska oil pipeline obviously transformed Alaska. It was at $9 billion, I believe, was a construction price, although that was in 1970s dollars. Does this project, if they build the big one, is it similar to that in terms of economic impact?
Well, in some ways, it will be, some ways not. It'll obviously be a huge construction project, a different kind of construction project. Pipelines, and particularly gas pipelines, are built these days. The pipe welding and the pipe laying itself is very automated. But the scale of this is so huge that the construction activity, the logistics, the freighting, the trucks on the roads, things like that are going to be even probably more substantial than the oil pipeline. What's important to remember about this project, though, is that it'll be a big it would be, if it ever moves ahead, be a big stimulus to the economy during the 2 or 3 years of construction. But it will not have the kind of transformative effect on the economy that the oil pipeline had, at least in one way. It won't bring the state a lot of revenue. And that's important to remember, that people get, they lose sight of the fact that the gas is not worth as much as the oil, and it costs a lot of money to take it to market. So the royalties and taxes the state will get are minuscule compared with what we make from oil. Oil is where the money is. And so we won't make a lot of money, a lot of revenue to our state treasury. In its operation, the gas pipeline won't create a lot of jobs in operating the pipeline. What it will do is it will help sustain the oil fields on the North Slope, help maintain that. So in that sense, it will help keep oil production going. Also, as once we have a gas pipeline, people will start exploring for gas for the first time. And when they explore for gas, they'll find oil. So in that kind of reverse effect, it'll have the effect of kind of reinforcing the existing oil and extending our existing oil industry. So it's the two working together, I think, that make a good package.
I often wonder if some of the excitement that folks have about the gas pipeline is the expectation that it's going to save our bacon as far as the decline of the North Slope oil fields, and that people are worried about our state budget going into deficit when 80-90% of it is paid for by the oil industry. But it sounds like that's really only possible as a secondary effect, where maybe the construction of a gas pipeline, it keeps the industry here looking for oil, and there's some subsidiary lucky
finds.
Right.
That's right. And it will have the effect of extending our existing oil industry. And if there's more exploration, it'll have a major stimulus effect on exploration on the slope, and we'll find more oil. Now, how much oil we'll find, I don't see. I'm one of those people who doubt that we'll ever see the pipeline even reach 1 million barrels a day again. But if it helps stabilize and stops the decline that we're seeing every year. And I'll say this, that if we don't have something that stops the decline, we're all going to be in trouble in a few years, because the budget impact of the steady 6% annual decline of oil production is going to be very serious in a few years. This year we saw a major reduction in our state capital budget because of that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just the beginning of the financial effects. So we got to do something.
I guess I just naively think that if there's oil there and it's worth $100 a barrel or thereabouts, that somebody would find it. Is that, how does the existence of a gas pipeline help people find oil?
Well, because as I mentioned, when you have a gas pipeline, you have a reason to go explore for gas. There are parts of the North Slope where the geology is more prone to natural gas. For example, the what are called the southern foothills of the North Slope. The prospects for natural gas, just because the way the geology has worked out, are higher than it is for oil. But people haven't really explored a lot down there because of, if they found gas, what would they do with it? Mm-hmm. The same thing is true in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. It's a huge area. It's 23 million acres set aside in 1923 for its oil potential. Ironically, not much oil has ever been found there. Small amount of gas, but the geologists think now, looking at it in retrospect, that it's much more gas prone than oil prone, except for a small part of the NPRA up toward the coast. But so once you had a way to move the gas to market, I think you would see a lot of people looking for gas. Again, it all depends on the economics of mm-hmm. it. But like I said, usually when you find gas, you find some oil also. So in that sense, it'll help reinforce the oil pipeline.
It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about the longtime dream that has lit the eyes of many Alaskan dreamer all the way back to the 1960s. Governor Wally Hickel had his gas project, which now looks kind of prescient in terms of what he wanted to do, and many other ideas that have gotten all the way to Wall Street and then fallen apart going back into the early 80s. And so a lot to talk about today about natural gas, and we invite you to get your questions or comments on the air. The number is 550-8433. If you're outside of Anchorage, it's 1-888-353-5752, and the email officially is hometownalaska@alaskapublic.org. My guests are Tim Bradner from Alaska Journal of Commerce and Larry Persley, who is the federal coordinator for the Office for Alaska Gasline Project. Tim.
Charles, I just wanted to add a bit of a historical perspective and also comment on what Larry said earlier about the gas resources of the North Slope. Just by way of history, as Larry said, we've been around this thing, you know, several generations and several variations of this gas project. And it seems like each time we build up a head of steam and a momentum, and then something happens to the market that craters the project. We've seen this happen three or four times now. And I think it's worth reflecting that the same thing almost happened to our oil pipeline back in the 1970s. Oil was discovered in the 1960s, late 1960s. Oil prices were $1, $2, $3. And I think had it not been for the accident of OPEC and the oil embargo from Iran in the late 1960s, 1969.
70s,
yeah. We probably would not have seen oil prices high enough to sustain the economics of the oil pipeline. I'm not sure it would have been built had oil prices remained at $3 or $4.
Yeah, and they were also looking at a lot of crazy alternatives to get it out. Larry, how does this decision finally get made? Because obviously Alaskans aren't going to be making the decision because we're not going to be the ones putting up the $40 to $60 billion.
Well, if you're talking about the companies making the decisions, BP, ConocoPhillips, Exxon.
Do they make the decision? Do the bankers make a decision? How does it happen?
It's going to be the companies. Individually, they're going to sit down. They're going to look at their prospects for investments. There's lots of places to drill in the world, lots of places to build liquefaction plants for natural gas, lots of operations to invest in. They're going to look at how much money they have to spend that year, next year, into the near-term future. Maybe their capital budget will be, let's pick numbers, maybe they say we've got $50 billion to spend in the next few years. We have $100 billion of proposals on the table today. Everyone's going to make their pitch. And the ones that can say this has the best chance of returning a profit measured against the risk. There are a lot of prospects out there that if everything works, boy, they're going to make a lot of money, a lot of risks, a lot of problems. So they're going to look and decide, is that the best allocation for their capital dollars? They're just like us, not as likable as us, but they're just like us, and they can't buy everything in the candy store that they want. So Alaska, particularly in the LNG market in Asia, which is very competitive right now, for this project to go ahead, the companies are going to be able to have to deliver gas at a cost that is competitive in Asia that returns them a profit on their $40, $50, $60 billion investment. Then they decide, do they want to take that money out of their own pocket? Do they want to go to Wall Street and borrow money? Do they want to sell bonds? Once they decide to go ahead with it, then they'll figure out where to get their share of the money to build it. Mm-hmm. Now, it's a little different, though, if the producers don't go ahead with the project and people go on the backup, the frustration plan, and say, darn it, don't know what you can say here. We're going to go build it ourselves. If the economics of that smaller line don't pay for themselves, then at some point it's possible, though certainly the promoters hope that it would pay for itself. It's possible, though, if the economics turn out, well, it really doesn't pay its bills at a reasonable price of gas delivered in Anchorage, then you might have to have the legislature decide, does the state want to get involved in a checkbook? One thing I want to get back to just very quickly, you and Tim were talking about, the having a gas project, if the companies decide to spend $40, $50, $60 billion on a natural gas pipeline that's going to last 40, 50 years, that's also an acknowledgement, a recognition, a commitment to keep the oil facilities running for 40 or 50 years, just as long. You can't have the gas line without the oil production facilities running concurrently. You need them both. Mm. So as we look at the gas line, yes, we'd get some benefits from that, like Tim said, not nearly as much cash in the bank as we do from oil, but you also give the companies a reason to keep investing and keeping the oil production facilities running just as long.
So to make this decision, the boardroom decision that Exxon or BP, some other big oil company would be making, that yes, we're going to invest in this line, they're presumably thinking that the product they're going to bring to the Far East in terms of gas is going to beat out some other product. What are we competing against? And what do we have to do to make that sale?
Yeah. I guess we're competing for potential LNG suppliers in the 2020s, 2030s, and beyond. Those are going to be projects in Australia, which are very high cost, projects that have been proposed for British Columbia to take shale gas from the remote northeast corner of British Columbia, pipe it 300-400 miles to either Prince Rupert or Kitimat on the BC coast, liquefy it, and send it into Asia. They have a whole set of problems. A lot of surplus gas in North America. There's proposals. There's one project being built in Louisiana, several more proposed, 19 more proposed, but most will never get built. Louisiana, Texas, Mississippi, and the U.S. Gulf Coast take some of that U.S. surplus gas, liquefy it, put in a tanker, run it through the expanded Panama Canal, and sell it in Asia. Russia has at least three liquefied natural gas projects that are in the proposal stage. Everybody wants to sell into Asia because they see it as a growth market with high price. That's what we've got to compete with. No one's going to build a $40 or $50 billion project on speculation. It's not like putting up a duplex in South Anchorage and hoping you sell it. You're not going to commit to it until the day that you have signed binding contracts with buyers at the other end to buy that gas long enough to cover the mortgage. Once you get those contracts, then the project looks pretty good. So that's what they would do, see if they can get contracts, see if they can get buyers, if there's a market, if we're competitive on price. Look, people pay more for Alaska salmon because it tastes better than that farm junk, right?
Right.
No one's going to pay more for our methane or natural gas. It burns the same. You can't command a premium just because it's got a Made in Alaska logo on it.
So it's all going to depend on the engineering of how much it costs to get it out of Alaska, yeah. And then I guess all the political stability. I mean, we're not going to have a revolution
right,
or something.
Right, political stability, how known and proved are those reserves, how accessible are they, what are the environmental laws, what are the risks of litigation, the terrain, you know, how many fault lines do you have to, how buildable is that project? And Tim touched on this. If you look at oil today, say $100 a barrel, about 10% of the value of that barrel gets eaten up in the transportation to move it down the pipe to Valdez and take it by tanker to a refinery, less than 10%. If you're talking liquefied natural gas off the North Slope, cleaning it, piping it, liquefying it, putting a tanker, by the time you land it in Tokyo, you've lost 75% of the value of that gas at today's prices in Asia to get it from the North Slope. So there's less margin to play with on natural gas than oil, so we just got to be more competitive.
Tim?
Charles, it's probably worth reflecting also what I mean, we have some strategic advantages in Alaska. We have a lot of disadvantages, but via our competitors. Larry mentioned the Australian competitors, which are probably, there's a lot of projects being developed. A lot of them are being hit with big cost overruns, but some of them are going to come online before ours will. They'll probably take the first part of the Asia market that's opening, which is in Japan and Korea. We're hoping that our project may be in that second range, you know, maybe in operation in the after 2020 at some point. So we have to look at, well, what's going to be left for us? And there'll probably be a fair amount left for us. China, maybe. The China market will continue growing. Each region where there are competitive projects have advantages and disadvantages. Australia's a bit farther away from us. The Persian Gulf has a huge amount of gas. It's farther away. So is the shipping cost, it's getting cheaper to ship LNG these days with large tankers, less of an issue. A big thing for us is we have a proven resource. We have all the infrastructure there. We don't have to drill a lot of wells. We do have to build a pipeline, though. Mm-hmm. Canada, cheap gas, potentially, in shale. It still has to be drilled and developed. They still have to build a pipeline, shorter one than ours. They have a lot of other problems. They have problems with getting deals with First Nations and right-of-ways and things like that.
So many variables involved, and plus changing prices, changing technology.
Right.
Is this why it never seems to come down because nobody can figure out the Rubik's Cube?
That's part of it. Or you're making a decision on a project that then you won't be selling that product for 8 to 10 years. Are you really certain the market's going to stay that way? Also, as I talked, it's expensive to get the gas off the slope, treat it, pipe it, liquefy it, and put in a tanker. Until 4 or 5 years ago, if you look at historical prices in Asia, until about 2008, if you had tried moving liquefied natural gas from Alaska to Japan, you would have lost money on it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until recently that the market price finally got to a point, hey, this thing is maybe possible, perhaps, sort of. So will that market hold? Will China develop its shale gas? Will Russia make peace with China, build a pipeline from Russia, and send Siberian gas to China and take over the market? You know, as Tim said, there's just a lot of unknowns and what-ifs, as I call them.
Throwing your 50 or 60 billion down on that kind of doubt is a scary thing. And I just have, if they'd built the pipeline that Governor Knowles or Governor Palin wanted them to build, I guess they would have gone broke by now because the price went down. And so they maybe made the right decision. We're going to take a break. It's Hometown Alaska. My guests are Larry Persley, the federal coordinator of the Office for Alaska Gas Line Project, and Tim Bradner, a resource reporter with the Alaska Journal of Commerce. We will be giving out the phone numbers to get you on the air if you have questions, and be talking about the Alaska Gas Line Project and when Hometown Alaska continues.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Hometown Alaska, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Hometown Alaska on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Hometown Alaska, I'm Charles Woolforth. Our topic today is the Alaska Gas Line Project, or projects, because there's more than one that's being talked about, moving this enormous resource of natural gas on the North Slope to the world market, to the lower 48, and even to Anchorage, where we seem to be running perilously short on gas on cold winter days. And I've got two great experts to talk about this today, Larry Persley, who's a federal coordinator, Office for Alaska Gas Line Project, and Tim Bradner, Alaska Journal of Commerce reporter on natural resources. And we'd love to hear your thoughts, questions, or comments. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. Email is hometownalaska@alaskapublic.org. Send an email in and I'll read your question or comment on the air. So the legislature during Palin's administration subsidized this AGEA project, which was sort of a something to get the ball rolling, I guess, and a lot of that money has been spent. And then there's been another investment made in a state-owned corporation, which is under the control of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, to look at this smaller pipeline. And we have another big energy project affecting our part of the state, which is the Wantana Dam, also known as the Sitna River Dam. A good deal of money was put into that project back in the 70s and 80s. Now it's on the front burner again. Tim, is it? Are we pursuing three things and only one can really happen? Or how do these ideas interlock? Is there a plan here?
Well, probably to say there's a plan is to be generous about it. I mean, looking at it from the outside, you can understand why people could see that this is a confused mess, that the legislature is going a lot of different directions and throwing money. Of course, we do have cash reserves in the bank that we could afford to do that for right now. And I guess in a broad sense, there is, I think, a kind of a logic to this. And if you think about it this way, the Alaskans are very frustrated by the repeated delays and failures of the various big pipelines projects that have come along for a lot of different reasons that have mostly to do with markets. But they feel basically like they have so little control, that these things are controlled by the market and by the corporation decisions made in out-of-state offices. So they felt like they wanted to have some way of influencing the thing. And ask the question, is there something we can do to influence this? And let me just go back real quickly to the time when Governor Murkowski tried to put together in 2004 and 2005 and 2006 a deal with the producers, which came very close to actually happening. Of course, had it moved, this was a pipeline to Canada in the lower 48, and had that moved forward, it would have been at risk from the shale gas at the time. But what happened was Governor Murkowski approached it from the standpoint of, let's make a business deal with the companies. Let's invest ourselves in the gas pipeline. And the proposal was for the state to own 20% of the project, to invest as a partner, and to sweeten the deal so the economics would work. And that seemed to be appealing to the companies, and they were receptive to that. It was moving forward. And then the legislature, part of it was to change the state production tax, and it got very complicated, and the whole thing slowed down. And then Governor Palin was elected and decided to take a different course. And her approach was a GIA, or the Gas Line Induced, the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act, which was a just a different way of going about it, putting a $500 cash subsidy into it and enticing a pipeline, independent pipeline company to come in, TransCanada, and to try to develop the project. So now the companies are all teamed up again, this time with TransCanada, under the framework of a GIA, so far at least, and that's why we're proceeding now on the LNG project. But meantime, Alaskans still felt like they wanted something in their hip pocket, and that's where this idea of the state-only, the state small gas pipeline would come along. Now, ostensibly, this would be to serve the Alaska markets as a fallback in case the big pipeline did not go forward. Arguably, you would, if you actually did that, you'd want to build it so you had the flexibility to expand the small pipeline to a bigger pipeline if you did want to have an export project. Maybe that can be done. Maybe it can't be done efficiently. The more intelligent way is to design a big project from the beginning so it's most efficient if you can make that work. But in any event, we're on two courses of action. One is the big pipeline led by the private sector, and the second course is the in-state system, which is a smaller project, which is being led by the state and hopefully some private partners. Whichever one happens,
it has to be one or the other, unless it's one that has a branch or something, right? I mean, it wouldn't.
Yeah,
build two
obviously you wouldn't have two pipelines going through Attican Pass, but I think if the big pipeline were to go, and it were to go to Valdez, for example, I think you would still have a spur line coming to Anchorage, and that's the role of the in-state gas project. Instead of building it all the way from the North Slope, it would build half of it, mm-hmm. and that would be the spur line coming to Anchorage.
We have a few phone calls here now. Let's get some of these folks on the air, and then we can go back to our open discussion here in the studio. And Gordon's calling from Anchorage. Gordon?
Yes. The latest news that I've seen on the large gas line is this consortium of, I think, utilities from Japan that are proposing a LNG project, and it always sounds very hopeful, but what are the kind of the inside issues on that one?
Tim?
Well, what's significant about that is that for the first time we've had some customers show up and say, we would like to buy some gas and we would like to be an investor in the project. And I think we're very early stage of that. They did their own very kind of preliminary assessment of what it would cost. What they're interested in is investing in an LNG plant and being a partner in an LNG plant, or maybe upstream of the pipeline if that was what people would desire. I think we're just at the beginning stages of that. I don't see that as a replacement necessarily of the big project, but they would be perhaps a part of something that would come together.
They don't represent the big utilities in Japan. They're not Tokyo Gas or Tokyo Electric. They're businessmen who see an opportunity to build and own and operate the liquefaction plant. They really don't want to do the pipeline. They really don't want to do the gas treatment plant on the North Slope. They would like to get that liquefaction plant and have people pay them to use a liquefaction plant. But as Tim said, it's nice to see some more interest.
Right, entrepreneurs then. All right, Bill calling from Anchorage. Bill, did you have a question?
Yeah, you could call it the Jumpin' Jack Flash show because, it's a gas. Anyway, so I worked for an outfit called Flying Tigers back in the 70s, and the price of gas went up. We were buying jet fuel from them, and we sued them and won. It took years. So we were able to buy gas at a price that we had established before everything went up. What would stop us from getting a storage facility and buying all the gas that we needed down in the States and storing it somewhere in Kenai and then maybe just building something from Anchorage to Fairbanks? Wouldn't that be cheaper?
You're talking natural gas?
Natural gas, yeah.
Well, there already is a storage facility that NSTAR and its partner built and opened up just this past winter in an old Marathon Reservoir gas field on Cannery Loop Road in Kenai, and the utilities Chugach, Municipal Light and Power, NSTAR are buying gas, putting it into the gas storage and pulling it out to meet winter needs. I think maybe, Tim, you know, I think they put $140 million into that. Their investment?
That could be expanded also to some degree.
But it all depends on getting the gas from somewhere to put in the storage facility. That's kind of the problem, right?
But you know, Bill, the other thing you mentioned was a gas line from Anchorage to Fairbanks to supply Fairbanks. And it's interesting to remember that the original idea of what later became the Bullet Line was a gas pipeline from, it was NSTAR's original proposal to build a line from Anchorage to Fairbanks to serve Fairbanks, because at that point it was thought that Cook Inlet had enough gas. We may yet have enough gas, so we could do that.
Right. Clearly, if you found a lot of gas in Cook Inlet, it'd be a lot cheaper to build a line from South Central to serve Fairbanks than to build all the infrastructure on the North Slope and drag it down the other direction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In other words, my argument is that we could probably legally support going out as a state buying a lot of gas really cheap.
But where would you buy it from?
Well, buy it from the West Coast.
Right, and then the only way to move it up here is to turn it into, liquefy it, build a liquefaction plant, which costs billions, build U.S. tankers, which are required by the U.S. law to move a commodity from a U.S. port to another U.S. port. They're $300 million a pop. And then another plant here to receive that gas, turn it, regasify it, put in the system. You could be $10 billion.
Too expensive, yeah.
Well, I guess at the end of the argument, where do you want your facility to be? Do you want it to be in Canada or do you want it to be in Alaska?
Yeah. Okay, Bill. Well, that's an interesting one.
And
I wanted to, we talked about it very briefly at the beginning, and we're going to get to Monique's call in just a minute, about the shortage or supposed shortage of gas here in Anchorage. And it seems like we're each winter being told, oh, we almost ran out of gas, you know, we almost had to have a blackout or whatever. But when we're talking about these projects, we're talking about things that are, you know, years or a decade in the future. It's kind of a mismatch there in terms of we're not going to, at least for our short-term shortage, we're not going to deal with that from the North Slope, eh, Tim?
Yeah, and one of the problems in Cook Inlet, the Cook Inlet thing is very complicated because there are also commercial issues at stake here. For example, we had a situation last year where we were really, the utilities were very worried about running short of natural gas, not just during the cold weather, but I mean on a year-round sustained basis. But what was going on was we had one company that was selling, Marathon Oil was selling to another company. That sale was held up by a federal a year-long Federal Trade Commission investigation, which just stopped everything. The purchasing company, Hillcorp, was unable to really know. We didn't know really how much gas Marathon had. And what really spooked the utilities is they were looking at the prospects of running out of gas by 2014 and 2015. And they actually had to go out, and they still have these plans to actually import natural gas to make up that deficit. Now, as it turned out, you know, the sale was finally consummated. Hillcorp was able to get into the Marathon fields, turn on the wells, repair some wells. And they do, there's more gas than they thought there. But it's not enough to really solve this long-term problem for Cook Inlet. We still have a problem.
At least it was no longer a crisis, it sounds like.
Right.
All right. Monique, you wanted to say something about Northwest Passage? Are you there, Monique?
Oh, yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Go right ahead.
You know, I mean, how brave and courageous would it be? And I have a question and then a comment. How brave and courageous would it be to go north? I mean, if things continue the way they are, going climate-wise, and I'm basing this on a documentary I saw with these folks that, you know, tried to take the Northwest Passage 13 years ago and got stopped by ice and then just sailed through 2 years ago with no ice. But how brave would it be for us to go north with that?
Ship it right out of the North Slope and build a pipeline at all. All right. And which was actually discussed in Oil Pipeline Days, the Manhattan tanker that was a fiasco.
So it shows how old we all are.
That's right. Tim?
Actually, the Manhattan was a technical success. It worked. I mean, they actually demonstrated, and it was interesting that it was the, it was a big showcase R&D project.
That was the idea of moving the oil, instead of building an oil pipeline, moving the oil straight right. from the North Slope. Well, and what about moving LNG from the North Slope?
In theory, you could do it. The complications, you run into some of the same issues you had with the oil pipeline, the oil movement by tanker, which caused the companies to prefer to do a pipeline. And that's the problem was the loading of it at Prudhoe Bay. The coastline is so shallow, you'd have to go out probably 20 or 30 miles to have an offshore loading terminal the water would be, the depth would be enough that the tankers could get in. And the prospect of doing that on a year-round basis in the heavy pack ice, even though the water is opening up in the Arctic, there's always going to be ice around and problems caused by ice, like we saw with Shell last mm-hmm. summer.
When people are talking about ice-free, they're talking about ice-free in summer. The idea of an ice-free winter in the Arctic is pretty far in the future.
Yeah, and you have to build a system that will operate a year round, of course. Now mm-hmm. you can operate tankers in ice. Exxon is doing it in mm-hmm. Sakhalin in very difficult ice conditions. But it's not quite like the Beaufort Sea. And so there's still mm-hmm. some issues. Technically it can be done. Like I think Larry said, if you throw enough money at something you can solve the problem. But it's a fascinating idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, why not? I mean, engineers are pretty smart people. They could take a look at that. I'm sure people have thought of it, too.
Right, and like Tim said, shallow water, you're going to have to build the world's longest dock jetty to get out there in deep water. You're going to have dredging issues. There's a lot of critical habitat up there for endangered species, whales, polar bears, seals, air quality emissions from all those tankers. And a liquefaction plant really does need to run full-time year-round. So if there are times where you can't get the tankers in the winter, you're going to have to spend billions building storage tanks to hold all that liquefied natural gas until the ice opens. You can get your ships in. I think there's a lot of environmental and technical reasons, maybe enough money, but I think probably pipeline makes more sense.
All right. Well, thanks, Money. Interesting question.
But,
you sparked our imagination.
Well, I mean, actually, in situations like this, you have to think out of the box. And mm-hmm. I'm sure there are people thinking in the industry thinking out of the box on this. For example, another idea is simply liquefying the gas into it using the process called Fischer-Tropsch to make it into a different type of liquid, but a liquid that you actually put in the oil pipeline. That's another idea that's
been worked
out.
So you don't have to build a pipeline. Yeah. Larry, Monique's question brings up the issue of climate change. And natural gas, maybe 10 years ago, was extolled by the environmentalists as a bridge fuel to get from coal, other high-carbon fuels, to renewables. Now more environmentalists are saying, no, just go straight to renewables. But there's a lot of debate on that. In terms of this gas being used in China or the Far East, is there expectation that it would displace coal and therefore would be a positive climate thing? Or on the other hand, if we're talking about getting the gas to the Far East only another 10 or 15 years, is it possible that at that point in the climate debate, people won't want gas anymore?
It's possible, but sure, China, and you look at China, China gets most of its energy. Last numbers I saw, 2011, I think 69% of China's energy came from coal, 5% from gas. Tremendous growth opportunity. Coal, and nothing against coal miners and the coal industry, coal is much dirtier in its emissions, and it's ash, it's waste, than natural gas. And you're right, the environmental community in America saw natural gas as cleaner burning, fewer emissions, better for the environment than coal. They saw a great opportunity. That's when they were thinking conventional natural gas. Now that 30-40% of U.S. natural gas production is from shale gas, which involves hydraulic fracturing, injecting water, sand, a little bit of chemicals deep underground, the environmental community, Sierra Club in particular, has turned against that. They are opposing fracking. They're opposing exports because they believe exports of lower 48 gas gives a market for all that fracking. They would like to stop hydraulic fracturing, or at least severely restrict it. So gas has lost some of its luster to the environmental community because so much of it now comes from hydraulic fracturing of shale rock with questions of emissions and water quality.
China is pretty strongly working towards reducing their carbon emissions. They've built
a lot
of windmills, and they've expressed that as, and their pollution problem obviously has to be dealt with. Is that something that enhances Alaska Gas, the fact that they would want to go that direction?
If as a national policy, China says we're going to reduce coal and we're going to increase natural gas, tremendous growth opportunities for liquefied natural gas suppliers, and hopefully an opportunity for Alaska.
They don't have their own?
China actually, by some estimates, has more shale gas than the United States. But the good thing for us is most of it is in the arid areas of China without water. And it takes 3, 4, 5 million gallons of water per well to do a fracking job on a shale gas well. So you've got to get all that water there, and then you've got to deal with the produced wastewater that comes back up. So it, even though China would like to produce its own shale gas rather than buy expensive imported gas, they're years and years away from that, and it's going to be a real challenge for them to do that. So hopefully, from Alaska's perspective, you'd like to see them buy liquefied natural gas from Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Charles, one of the things about the technology changes in the industry that could really be a wild card in this is that if we, at some point, I'm sure smart scientists are going to figure out a way to clean up coal and clean it in a way of transforming it, taking all the bad stuff out of it, and probably it's going to happen in the form of converting it to a liquid that, you know, like conventional gas or oil. And I think we may not be that far away from that sort of thing. It's going to be expensive, and we're going to go through a long learning process, but I think it'll happen, and that could be kind of a game changer, too, because in terms of the broader climate issue, because some of the issues with the use of coal right now might be changed in that kind of a transformation.
Mm-hmm. You know, it strikes me that if I were to be an oil company executive or chairman of the board deciding whether I wanted to make this investment, I might well think very, very carefully about it because of all the uncertainties we've talked about in terms of technology and markets and politics. Larry, I know you are in a position of working for the federal government, but you also have studied this a lot. I mean, what is the probability that we're actually going to see something happen in the next few years, or are we just going to keep talking about the issue that we were talking about when I was a child?
Well, let's see. When I first started this job 3 years ago, I went to Ottawa, had a meeting with a minister of something in Ottawa, I forget what minister, before my rear end even hit the chair at this first meeting with her and her entourage. She said, okay, what are the odds we're going to get this thing built? And I thought, well, that's one question I hadn't prepared for. So trying to think like a bureaucrat in Washington, I said, oh, I don't know, 50-50.
Yeah.
I'd probably say the same thing. Alaska and Bill's talked about, Tim, I'm sorry, you know, there are a lot of advantages. We're closer to Asia than Canada, than the U.S. Gulf Coast, than the Middle East. We have proved reserves. Relatively stable politics compared to some places, certainly. Some good cost structure. We have some disadvantages. We got 800 miles of pipeline we got to build. High construction costs. If the state can work with the producers, put together a fiscal package, if the producers, if things fall our way, if China continues to move from coal to gas, doesn't develop its own, if Japan doesn't restart all 50 nuclear plants, if the world's economy builds, energy demand goes up, I think there's a decent chance that in the 2020s you could have Alaska gas flowing. But those pieces have to fit mm-hmm. together. And as Tim pointed out, Alaskans have to get realistic. You are not going to get filthy, stinking rich off a gas line. The numbers just aren't there. But you can make money off a gas line, and you can get gas for decades to Alaskans. That's not a bad deal.
And I want to give Tim a chance to answer that if he wants to later, but we have one last call here with a few minutes left. Juliana, you had a question?
Oh, I do, yes. I wonder if either of your interviewees think that we would benefit from a socialized policy. Alaska itself would benefit from a socialized policy on our resources, oil and gas resources.
As in the government would build the project and own the project? That is that what you have in mind?
I want a policy.
So what would you, how would you define the socialized policy?
Oh, dear. Something that our state would put into effect and say, this is how we see things and that's how it's going to be.
Okay, so we just own it, we run it. Tim?
Well, this is in a sense what is a little bit behind the in-state gas system. It's the state corporation sitting back and saying, this is our back strategy. If the private sector doesn't go along with the bigger one, this is one we can do. And the work that's being done right now by the Alaska Gas Line Development Authority is to really just prepare, to be prepared in case we have to make that decision. So that's kind of what you're going in the direction of what you're saying.
One thing we've learned over many years of watching projects in Alaska, as the three of us certainly have done, is that when the state has to put a lot of money into something that private industry doesn't want to, it often means that it's not a good project. I mean, that otherwise we wouldn't have to invest a lot of money. What's the advantage of the state building a line that private industry doesn't? Tim, I know you're not here to defend it, but what would be the advantages?
Well, I don't think the state, probably if I had to make a guess, I don't think the state would undertake the entire project by itself. I don't think the legislature is going to be willing to write a big checkbook and essentially bet the permanent fund indirectly probably. But I think what they would say, what they always say, is they would have to do it in some form of partnership with private companies. So I think what would probably happen is you'd see another effort at some sort of a coalition with larger companies. Maybe if the big project as it's conceived now does not move forward, people would step back and say, well, let's see if we can put this deal together. And maybe you might wind up with something like what Governor Murkowski had. In fact, that is in the Alaska Gas Line in HB4, which just passed the legislature, is the concept that the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation would be the instrument for the state investing and being a partner in a larger project. So that may be the way this comes out.
And I didn't ask you the same question. And thanks, Juliana. Good question. I didn't ask you, Tim, to answer the same question as Larry, as the probabilities. But that, I guess that's sort of the fallback. You want to take that one in just a short time we have left?
Oh, I sort of agree with Larry. I think it's probably too early to really know whether it has realistic. I mean, there's so many. It is so complicated, and we have so many things going for us and against us. I'd hesitate to be to try to make a guess at it. I will say though that we'll probably get an indication sometime this summer if the producers agree to go to the next stage of the project and commit more money. I mean, that's a positive sign. If it doesn't happen.
Agreed, Larry? You think
right,
that's...
Right, because if the producers say they're going to lay out several $100 million to get out there and do field work, environmental work, design work, to move this along to the next step, they're not going to do it if they think this has no chance, if it's a waste of time. No one likes to spend that much money. They can send their people somewhere else. So I agree with Tim. We should get some indication this summer. More of an indication, do they continue spending on design next year? The in-state project goes out and tests the markets, see if there's any customers that want to pay their bills in 2015. So next couple of years, we should get a pretty good indication of if there's hope or if we all just beat our heads against the wall again.
One more time. All right. Well, this has been fascinating. I appreciate my two guests. I know a lot more about the subject than I did before. We did receive a few emails right there in the last minute that we don't really have time to get into. So I'll go ahead and post those on our Facebook page for Alaska Public, and you can take a look and debate those there. So thanks very much to Larry Pursley, Federal Coordinator at Office for Alaska Gas Line Project. Thanks for being with us. And Tim Bradner from the Alaska Journal of Commerce. Thanks for being my guest. Next week on Hometown Alaska, join Kathleen McCoy for a discussion about the Spinard Jazz Fest. We cover the waterfront around here. Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org. You can join us on Facebook at Alaska Public. I'll be putting those questions up there. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron was our audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth.
Hometown Alaska is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.